This is an interview with Dan Dixon. Today is March 27th, 2014, and this is Adam Chile conducting the interview. So, one thing I like to ask in the beginning of interviews is, what attracted you to climate science?
Very good question. Mm-hmm. Well, really, I kind of fell into it by chance, and it's a long story. It goes way back to my undergrad, and I was doing geology and oceanography at the University of Southampton in England. Mm. And originally, I had planned to join the British Royal Navy as an oceanographer, going out on their research vessel and scanning the ocean, seeing the world that way. Mm. So one of my real goals was to see the world. Mm. So then one of my courses in oceanography was paleoceanography with Ilko Rolling, was my professor. Mm. And he happened to be a good friend of Paul Majewski. So towards the end of my undergrad, I was in my third year doing my finals. Mm. I went to the 3-day interview with the Royal Navy, and it ended up that the first day of the interview, I turned 26 on that day. Mm-hmm. So I went through the interview all 3 days. Then on the last day, they took me into this office. We had this sort of face-to-face with an admiral, a captain, and someone from Secret Service or something. Mm-hmm. And they basically asked me a whole series of questions and sent me out of the room. So then everyone who was there at the 3-day sort of testing, and then we all ended up sitting around waiting to hear the result. My result came back, and it was, "I'm sorry, you're not quite what we're looking for." So I had gone through many, many years thinking that's what I was going to do. Then all of a sudden I figure out, oh no, I'm not doing that. Mm. You know, just like that.
Right.
It changed from one day to the next, literally.
So it must have been a bit of a blow.
It was a bit of a blow, yeah. And it turned out I was too old. You're supposed to be under 26 on your day of entry if you want to join into officer training.
Yeah.
And I was too old because I had taken time off after high school.
Mm.
Mm. So I didn't really know what I was doing, but I finished my finals anyway. Then I think right towards the end of my finals, I don't know if it was my last exam or even after my last exam, but I got this email from Ilko. Not to me personally, he sent it out to his whole class. And it said, oh, you know, there's this guy in the USA, he's moving to Maine, mm-hmm. running an institute. Mm-hmm. He's interested in finding grad students who are willing to work and study in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. So I thought, wow, you know, Antarctica, USA. You know, it's not quite seeing the whole world, but it's a start. So I responded to Paul. Mm-hmm. We exchanged several emails, had a couple of phone conversations, and the end result was he told me to, you know, apply officially to UMaine. Uh-huh. And plan to come over. Mm-hmm. So the whole application process ended up taking over 3 months because I had to do GREs, had to apply for passport, visas. Mm. Then at that point I could do the grad school application. And so I ended up arriving here in October of 2000 to do a master's. Mm. And during my master's I must have gone to Antarctica at least twice, maybe even 3 times. And I also went to southern Patagonia.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
I got right into the spirit of things, you know. Yeah. Going on expeditions with Paul and drilling ice cores and and doing my master's. So that's really what... And then, of course, I was hooked at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So really a bit of good fortune that the Royal Navy turned you down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it wasn't long after that September 11 happened. Trade towers were hit. Countries around the world went to war. In the Middle East.
Right.
And who knows? Who knows what would have happened to me at that point.
Right. Before your first trip in Antarctica, what did you think it would be like?
In Antarctica?
Mm-hmm.
Cold. windy. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, when you read about Antarctica, you typically read about, you know, Scott of the Antarctic and Shackleton, Amundsen, mm-hmm. and you read about their tales and how tough it was, and you kind of go expecting that. And I remember before I left, I sat down with Paul. I said, look, I just need to know, what is it really like? You know, what am I really, really going to need? Mm-hmm. And he basically said to me, you're going to need all your own clothes. Right. That was his gem of advice, and it turned out to be absolutely true, because the clothing that the Antarctic program provided was, you know, probably 20 years old.
Really?
Yeah, horrible nylon, scratchy stuff that you wouldn't wear if you could help it. Mm-hmm. So luckily, he was kind enough to pay for some nice Patagonia base layer stuff for me, mm-hmm. some nice socks.
Right.
You know, decent wind blockers and things like that, and nice hat and gloves.
It's funny that that wouldn't be provided to you.
Oh, it is provided. I didn't say it's not provided. I said it's about 20 years old.
Right.
And
right.
so it's perfectly adequate, but it's just...
uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly well-known fact. You can tell... usually when you're in Antarctica, you can tell the people that have never been before, because they're all wearing the standard issue gear.
Yeah.
Mm. Everyone who's been more than once
wears
their own stuff. Yeah, I mean, you know, you could get away with wearing the kind of thing you'd wear if you were walking in the woods in the middle of winter in Maine. You could get away with that. You just need multiple layers. So you have more fleece on underneath. Mm-hmm. Really good base layer. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and you cover up your entire body because of the UV.
Mm. Right.
So luckily, you know, Paul, with all his Antarctic experience, sort of gave me enough of a heads up so that I didn't feel like a proper newbie.
Right.
You know, when I was there, right. even though it was my first year, it was still a shock. I mean, yeah. it was really, really cold. And it's not just cold where you go out and you get cold, you come back in and warm up. It's cold. It's always cold. I mean, we were working outside for the majority of the day. You know, while we're coring, drilling the cores. So you really, you know, you adapt fast. So the first week was really tough. Second week, tough. Third week, your body sort of clicks into overdrive, starts producing a whole load of heat, burning calories super fast, mm-hmm. and you just can stand outside in the cold.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how fast the body does adapt in those conditions.
Yeah, that is amazing. Mm. I'm wondering if you can walk me through the nuts and bolts of ice core drilling.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the premise behind it, the whole reason for doing it, is that as the snow falls through the atmosphere, it picks up the chemistry in the atmosphere. So it acts a bit like a sponge as it falls. So then it lands on the ground, and you have the record of the atmosphere when the snow fell. Mm-hmm. So if the area where that snow fell is super cold, and there's enough snow on a regular basis to cover it up and bury it so it doesn't all get blown away mm-hmm. or ablated by the sun. So providing those conditions are met and the accumulation is high enough, you've basically got a record of atmospheric chemistry going back however deep your core, your ice, your glacier is, you know, or ice sheet or whatever. So So the project I was working on, we were looking at timescales about 200 to 1,000 years. So we were drilling about 100 to 150 meters mm-hmm. deep. And the drill we were using was solar-powered, electromechanical drill that extracts a 3-inch diameter core a meter at a time. So you go up and down, same hole, 150 times. It takes about a week. And of course, you're standing outside that whole time. The core comes out, you know, a single meter. You push it out of the barrel. Then you measure it, you weigh it, you log it, you pack it, and you label it. And you just get it into these insulated boxes. Because even though you're in the middle of Antarctica and it's minus 30, mm-hmm. The sun is so intense that it has to be protected from the sun. So you put it in these 2-inch thick wall, foam insulated, bright white boxes, so they reflect most of the energy.
I see. And so each core, so you know where each core is in the depth, even though.
So generally, when we name these things, you know, for instance, if it was drilled in the 2001 field season, we called it 01. If it was site number 2, we'd call it 2. And then if it was the 5th drill run, just label it 5. So it'd be 0125.
Right. And so you would know that. And then the next 5 meters deep.
Well, you know that. Well, in our logbooks, we measure each piece as it comes out. It's not exactly a meter. So perhaps. You know, perhaps it would have been, you know, from 4.6 to 5.4 right. meters depth. But it was run number 5.
Gotcha.
It was drill run number 5. So that's how we would log it.
Mm-hmm.
So we just had this logbook. Each time the drill would go up and down, you log what comes out.
Yeah.
And you measure it, and then eventually you reach 150 meters depth.
Right.
It might take 200 runs.
Mm-hmm. How many people does that typically require for a job like that?
For the ice core drilling, we have one driller and generally 2 ice core handlers.
Uh-huh.
And then we had the luxury of having a third person to help the driller. That was typically Paul. He would help the driller. And then myself and my fellow grad, another fellow grad student would be the ice core handlers.
Uh-huh.
That was typically how we would run it. But we were on an oversnow traverse called ITAS, which is International Transantarctic Scientific Expedition.
Mm.
And this was a project thought up and put into action by Paul, who's my boss, director of the institute, Paul Majewski. And it involved 21 different countries. So we were just involved in the US effort.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to drive across the ice sheet, you know, each country driving over a different area and doing science along the way, coordinating our science. So we were all drilling cores, we were all doing ground penetrating radar, we were all doing GPS.
Uh-huh.
So we're basically turning Antarctica from one of the lesser known continents scientifically into one of the better known continents. That was the preface behind it.
Right. Wow.
And it was great. I mean, I went there 5 times with ITAS, on ITAS expeditions. I drove more than 10,000 kilometers,
mm-hmm.
and our top speed was 5 miles an hour.
So the idea was basically to core, to extract cores from every major section of the ice sheet.
Yes, and the way we chose where to drill the cores is our initial goal was to space them out approximately 300 kilometers apart. And then we would take surface snow samples every 30 kilometers between core sites.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in order to figure out where to drill, you have to look at your radar, because you have to make sure you've got nice internal layers,
mm-hmm.
so they're nice and straight and no folding or missing sections or
mm-hmm.
hiatuses, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was typically our routine. We would drive along, and we had to go 5 miles an hour because we were towing the radar. We had
right.
3 different radars. We had deep radar, which was seeing all the way down to the bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
And the ice in some areas is 4,000 meters thick.
Wow.
I mean, it's a serious ice sheet in Antarctica. Yeah. So this low-frequency radar could see all the way through that, see the internal layers and see the bedrock. Then we had a medium-frequency radar that would see down about 150 meters, and that would show up the internal layers near the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a higher frequency radar that was on the lead vehicle, and that was used as a crevasse detector.
Mm-hmm.
So that would give us data in real time on a screen that we would look at while we were driving,
mm-hmm.
so that we could shout stop if we saw a crevasse.
And what was the agreed upon length of the cores per?
It was our aim was to get between 200 and 1,000 years of record. So depending on the accumulation rate, the depth could vary. So, for instance, 200 years at South Pole is about 30 meters. 200 years at the base of the Antarctic Peninsula, where you get a lot of snow, is about 150 meters.
Wow.
So it's that much different. And then there are other areas in East Antarctica where the accumulation is less than 2 centimeters a year, mm-hmm. where you can get 200 years of record in, you know, 10 meters of core. Mm-hmm. So it varies. It varies. So we would typically drill cores between 50 and 100 meters on most areas. That was mm-hmm. enough. Then occasionally you get into these high accumulation zones, and then you'd need a deeper core, 120, 150 meters, mm-hmm. to reach that 200-year mark. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we were going 200 years was because there's a large volcanic eruption in 1815. You may have heard of it, Tambora. It created the Year Without a Summer, which was the year that Frankenstein was written. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And that was such a large volcanic eruption that it basically blocked out the sun. Or at least it didn't block it out, but reduced the power of the sun for an entire year just because of all of the aerosols in the upper atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was called the Year Without a Summer. You know, crops failed, and it was like having a year-long winter.
Wow.
Before that, all those particles eventually settled down mm-hmm. and allowed the sun back. So that shows up as a giant sulfur peak in the records. Because what we do after we've drilled the core, we look at the chemistry, mm-hmm. you know, layer by layer all the way down. And so if we, as long as we can go back to the Tambora peak, we know, we then have an isochrone that we can track from site to site. And it helps us, correlate the cores to one another.
Right.
Cross-correlate mm-hmm. and date, and it allows us to date them more accurately as well. Well,
that sounds like quite an undertaking to bring so many different nations into that effort.
Yeah, Paul was really... Paul and Ian Goodwin, his good friend, they're really the two behind that. I was just focused on the US ITAS, so I was just focused on what we were doing. Mm-hmm. I did go to the international meetings, but you know, I was just a master's student at the time, so I didn't really have a clue who our international colleagues were and how important they were and how famous they were.
Right.
But I learned over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you said that before your first trip to Antarctica, you read the accounts of some of the earliest expeditions.
Yes. Scott, in particular, because he's the most famous because he reached the pole and then died.
Right.
Yeah.
When you were there in Antarctica, traversing over places that few humans really had seen, did you think of yourself as an explorer?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt like a modern explorer, you know, mm-hmm. like using all our technology, all the technology at our disposal, to cross Antarctica as efficiently as possible so that we can, you know, complete our goals. Because we had a lot of science to do. We had probably, you know, 5 or 6 different science groups in our traverse team, probably about 15 of us. Mm. And so trying to coordinate all that so that everyone can get their science done successfully, mm-hmm. you know, that was really Paul's job. He was the field leader for the science and really for safety as well. But I think being the scientific field leader is you know, you have to be a bit of a politician because you've got all kinds of competing mm-hmm. requirements, and you have to make a decision sometimes where one of those may not get done. You know, in the interest of safety or timing or something. So I think he was in a very difficult position, and I used to watch with great interest how he would handle everyone, you know, and handle all the requirements. I was lucky because Paul's science was my science, so I didn't have to worry too much about it.
Can you think of a specific example of maybe a difficult situation that he navigated?
Yes, there was one point when we were where we began to approach crevasse fields in the drainage basin of Taylor Glacier on the 2006 traverse, we had looked at the satellite data and planned our route based upon that. Because up to that point, everyone had used the satellite data to avoid crevasses, you know, because the crevasses show up as bright spots on the radar sat image. So, you know, Gordon Hamilton, who was also on the traverse with us, and some of his colleagues had spent, you know, days and days looking at these satellite images, getting us a safe route out of a certain site that had crevasses. So we knew where we needed to go. And so we started driving along, and then we started to notice that the ground was very unusual. There was cracks. There was like weird, like spiderweb type patterns on the surface. And when you like crack through them underneath, they were little tiny cracks that got bigger as they went down. And it was very unusual. And no one really knew what they were, and we felt like we were really in unknown territory at that point. So normally, you know, the way the traverse moves is you know, we have three trains, well, two trains and a third motorized unit. So the first unit is, it's basically a piston bully, like a ski groomer that they use on Sugarloaf or something. Yeah. And it has a, you know, a 40-foot boom on the front, and then the crevasse detecting radars on that. Mm-hmm. So that would normally go up ahead, and then half a kilometer behind, or a kilometer varying, the second train would follow, because that was pulling a radar system. So it didn't want to be too near any other metal objects, because it would reflect the signal and mess up the returns. So that's why we would follow that, you know, half a K or a K back. And then the third group was towing the deep radar, and they wanted to be like a kilometer back, because the deep radar didn't want to get returns off of the middle group. Mm-hmm. So we were basically spaced out a fair distance and moving along very slowly. And most of the time in West Antarctica, we were on ice divides, and these are very safe areas where they're high points on the ice, so all of the flow is either down or outwards from that point, but it's relatively slow flow, so there's no cracking, no crevasses. So we, you know, we had gotten very, very much used to that mode of travel. Then we ended up at Taylor Dome, which is in East Antarctica, and it's also downflow of an area called mega dunes, which are these huge dune features on the ice sheet surface. Mm. And there's all kinds of like crazy surface processes going on in those dunes. Like certain, you get accumulation in one zone, and then you get a scour zone where there's no accumulation, like right next to it, where the surface is like solid glass and the tractors don't even make a mark, and it's, you know, and there's thought to be hiatus surfaces, you know, hundreds of years old. But that was all upflow of where we were. So we were moving along. We left this place called Taylor Dome. We were moving along, heading south, because we were going back to the pole. But we had our route mapped out using the radar sat imagery. And then we started to notice these little micro cracks in the ground. And the problem with those is that they were giving us crevasse signatures in our lead radar, because they're cracks. They're basically tiny little crevasses. Mm-hmm. And I think, and after talking to a whole series of experts, we think that those are formed because of airflow through the snow surface. So the air flows through, it's kind of like electricity, it follows the path of least resistance. Mm-hmm. So once that path is established, the air continues to flow that way, and it ablates more and more of the snow. Mm-hmm. From that whatever path that is, and that ends up forming these crazy like spiderweb cracks everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's why they get bigger as you go down,
right?
Because it's where the air is going. Yeah, so the snow is basically being moved in the air from down below, coming up to the surface through these cracks. Mm-hmm. And then recrystallizing on the surface and forming these glazed layers. Mm-hmm. Like, wow. A giant sheet of glass. Mm-hmm. So it basically rendered our crevasse detector useless. So at that point, Paul made the decision that we needed to travel closer together, because if someone did go in a crevasse, you needed to be, help needed to be there. You couldn't be 2 kilometers back, moving along at 5 miles an hour, arriving 20 minutes later. If someone goes in a crevasse, you've got to get right over to them and get them out. So he made that decision at that point. And of course, the people on the radar weren't too happy, because it meant that these metal tractors and sleds had to move closer together, mm-hmm. which then changed everything. Hmm. So that was just one example. There were many others as well, I'm sure.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Were you ever on an expedition in which either you or somebody you were working with almost got injured or did get injured?
There's been minor injuries. I mean, there always is. People hitting their thumbs with hammers and stuff, or falling in holes. No one's ever gone into a crevasse on any expedition I've been on. Mm-hmm. No severe injuries. No cuts. We had sprains, of course. You know, when you're hiking in the mountains, you sprain your ankle.
Yeah.
I, one time, on the 2001 Traverse, we drove to the base of the Antarctic Peninsula, and there was a giant storm coming, so we decided to try and drill a core quickly, mm-hmm. And then try and pack everything away and get away before the storm hit. Mm-hmm. So we were operating pretty quickly, much faster than we normally would. Setting up the core site, you know, lifting these big heavy boxes that were full of our drilling equipment. I ended up putting my back out, like, really badly.
Really?
Like, I remember I turned around, I leant down, grabbed the handle of the box, went to lift. Something clicked at the base of my spine, and I just went down, hit the floor. Couldn't move. Mm. Meanwhile, everyone's trying to drill the core. I'm useless. I'm lying on the ground. Mm. I think, actually, maybe it was after we drilled the core. Maybe we were packing away at that point, and the storm was approaching. So I couldn't help pack the sleds. I couldn't get everything packed up ready, you know, so that we could leave quickly. And people were busy, you know, trying to, like, straighten me out. You know, people were, like, lifting me up under the arms. Like, this usually works. Yeah, let me try this. I was like, ah! And then, of course, all I really needed to do was lie down and rest. But lying down in your bunk and traveling over the ice sheet surface is a nightmare. It's like being on a frozen ocean. So these sleds, right, you know, they've got 4 pontoons that all move independently. So as these sleds move over the land, these pontoons are sort of going as they go over the different bumps and lumps. Geez. So it's like being on a boat, but then at the bottom of every wave is hard.
Yeah.
So I was lying in my bunk, like, I was like, oh.
Probably didn't help too much.
No, well, I don't know. Maybe it did. Maybe it sort of jarred me into back straight again. But after a couple of days, I was okay. Mm-hmm. And of course, I took it easy. And we drilled a couple more sites on the way back. And by that point, I was okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that's one of my worst injuries. Oh, there was one time. We were on a volcano in the Andes, and we had just been up there, just drilled a core. We were on our way down, and I got a bladder infection.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I couldn't pee. Well, I could pee, but only drops would come out, and it was like liquid fire. And so I couldn't pee. And I didn't know what I was going to do, and Paul's been in these kind of situations before, so he always carries a catheter in the medical kit.
Yeah.
That's like the first thing he says, make sure there's a catheter in the medical kit.
Yeah.
So I was thinking to myself, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to use the catheter. I'm not looking forward to this. It's going to be a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And we still had like 2 days hike mm-hmm. to get out of the valley, just to get to the trailhead where the van could pick us up, where then we were like another day to get to Santiago. Mm-hmm. So I was panicking, and And Paul said to me, you know, wait one more night. If it's not better by morning, then start taking your Cipro, because we all carried antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about putting this catheter in. I didn't wait. I started taking my Cipro right away. Okay. As soon as he sort of gave me the idea, I was like, yep, that's what I'm going to do. And I took it, and next morning I could pee.
Phew. Wow.
Yeah.
What a story.
Because, you know, you can die. If you can't pee, you get an infection in your bladder, and it'll move into your kidneys, and you get blood poisoning, and that's it. You can be a goner within days.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, I wasn't that worried, because, you know, we were only a couple of days hike out, and then a day to Santiago. I mean, could have always called in a helicopter if it was a real emergency, but
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't very comfortable, let's put it that way.
Right. No, yeah. I cannot imagine that it was.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So that's my back going out, and that other times, there was one time in Southern Patagonia. I've got loads of these stories. One time in Southern Patagonia, we knew we were going to be doing a lot of heavy walking with heavy packs.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul recommended that we all buy these insoles. I don't know what they're called, but they're bright red. And you put them in the oven and you warm them up. Then you put them in your shoe and then you stand on them for a few hours and they mold to the shape of your foot and they give you perfect arch support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever shape your foot is, they mold to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got these things and I tried it in my boot without putting it in the oven. I thought, that feels all right. So I didn't bother ovening them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't bother trying to reshape it. I just thought it was good.
Yeah.
It turns out it wasn't good. It was giving me way too much arch support. Uh-huh. So it was pushing up in the middle. So once we actually got to this glacier in Southern Patagonia, I started walking on these things. I went up and down once and my feet were swollen. I couldn't... Uh-huh. I mean, literally, I could barely walk.
Huh.
And I would have been just an absolute burden on the rest of the group. I mean, it was awful. It's a horrible feeling when you're in that, you know, not only are you sick in a remote place,
mm-hmm.
but you feel like you're ruining the expedition
mm-hmm.
because everyone has to worry about you and care for you and do all that.
Sure.
So it's just a terrible feeling. So I tried to tough it out. I ended up duct taping up my feet. Like just wrapping duct tape around them to try and compress them a bit. Then luckily I had a spare set of hiking boots that where the insoles came out.
Mm-hmm.
So I pulled the insoles out of those, put them into my mountain boots, because we had to wear hard plastic mountain boots with crampons and stuff, so we're walking up solid ice. And it worked. The swelling went down. I wore the duct tape for about 2 or 3 days. Took some painkillers, took some ibuprofen, that probably helped reduce the swelling.
Mm.
So, wow. and then managed to like keep going, keep up with everyone while we were going up and down carrying gear.
Yeah.
Because we had to do multiple trips up and down to get... We had a camera crew with us as well.
Wow.
So,
how many people were involved in that expedition?
In that expedition, there was Paul, Andre, Eric, and I. We were like the science group. Then we had two camera guys with us, one cameraman, one sound guy. Then we were all on a boat, which was being skippered by Charlie Porter.
Mm-hmm.
And he and then his first mate, Juan, who was this like proper Chilean Indian guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, totally dark skinned, hooked nose. Just looked like he was from Cape Horn, and he spoke no English, and he was so stoic. He would eat his dinner out on the back of the boat, even if there was a storm going on. That's what he liked, you know, being outside. His skin was like elephant hide. It was amazing. He was a tough guy. Then we had these two Swedish, we had a Swedish couple with us. They were like the cook, but they were doing like cook's duties on the boat. So we're on the boat, there was the Swedish couple, Charlie Porter and Juan. Charlie would ferry us to the land off of the boat in a little Zodiac, and then there would be six of us on the land, so the four science crew and the two camera crew.
Mm.
And then we would do our trips up and down the glacier, our drilling, our filming. Then Charlie would come back and pick us up and get us back to the boat. That was kind of how that one was operating.
Yeah.
That was exciting.
Sounds like you've had quite a few adventures.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so October of 2012, went to South Georgia with Paul. That was another exciting one. We had to leave from the Falkland Islands and then sail across the Southern Ocean, crossing the Antarctic Convergence to get to South Georgia. 3.5 days there with just squalls blowing through every, 4 hours pretty much. Mm-hmm. And the boat didn't have roller reefing on the main. So we had to, every time a squall would come through, we had to walk out onto the deck and adjust the main by hand.
Wow.
And if these squalls were coming every 4 hours, so it was just constantly in and out, in and out, in and out. And we were doing, I think the science crew were doing 6 hour shifts. The boat crew were doing 6 hour shifts. Science crew, we were doing 4 hour shifts. Or was it 8 and 6? I don't remember. But
yeah.
3.5 days out, I decided not to wear, the patch, seasickness patch. I managed to last like 3 days. And then the last half day I got seasick right before we arrived.
Mm-hmm.
So on the way back, I decided I was going to wear the patch. The scopolamine thing. It goes behind your ear and delivers drugs to your brain. I don't know how safe they are, but apparently everyone uses them. And it worked. I was still a bit seasick for the first 3 days. And then they only last 3 days and you're supposed to put another one on. So I was sort of fighting off seasickness for the first 3 days. Then it came time to put on the other one. I went to get the old one off and it wasn't there. And I was like, oh, damn, where is it? And then all of a sudden, knowing it wasn't there, I don't know whether my brain just fooled me, but all of a sudden, as soon as I realised that it wasn't there, I got seasick immediately.
How about
that? So then there was like 3.5 more days of seasickness, because on the way back it was 6.5 days.
Yeah.
So the way back was pretty miserable.
Hmm.
So, but it was still great fun. Yeah. I mean, it was awesome. It was a crazy experience that I wouldn't trade for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually, once we were, moored up on South Georgia in, I can't remember where we were. We were at Grytviken. Grytviken, the abandoned whaling station where Shackleton is buried. So we even saw Shackleton's grave. And, once you're moored up there, you have the protection of the island. It's such a beautiful place. It's amazing. But also spooky, because there was like whale bones coming out of the ground from, 60 years of whaling activities at this place.
Incredible.
Yeah. Jeez. It looked like they were growing. They were just literally bone here, bone there, a giant skull coming out over there, ribs over there. It's like, wow. Can't imagine what that place would have been like when it would have been operating.
Right.
There would have been carcasses floating and the water would have been red.
Yeah. So, you stayed at Maine after your master's.
Yeah. So I loved, the expedition lifestyle and the research. I felt like, investigating climate is a worthwhile occupation in terms of, am I doing good for the planet? I definitely had an environmental and an ecological concern ever since I was much younger, because my mum was a science teacher and she taught me in middle school, and her hero was David Attenborough, who does the Life on Earth series in England. Mm-hmm. So I grew up watching that stuff, and we had huge thick David Attenborough books in our bookcase, and I used to spend days and days just like leafing through them. So I definitely was like pre-programmed to care about the environment and stuff. Mm. But once I was on these expeditions, not only was it great fun and really exciting and, like adventuring, but I was also gathering data that was, helping to save the environment, helping understand climate change and inform policymakers. And I felt like it was worthwhile. And I think that's really part of what convinced me to stay on and do the PhD was, you know, the feeling that I was doing something worthwhile, also the fun of it all. And also I wanted to get my PhD, of course.
Sure.
And Paul was willing to keep me on. So I felt like I was, you know, I had a good relationship going with him, and he was giving me more and more responsibilities, and I enjoyed that. And it was nice. Because I was starting to build equipment and do a bit of the drilling. And I ended up pretty much being, you know, the local drill engineer. You know, so anything would go wrong with the drill, I would fix it. And then if people were going to take the drill out on an expedition, I would get it ready for them, make sure it was all working, you know. So bring it back the way I give it to you. And if they, you know, of course people break stuff, but they bring it back, it's all broken, I would fix it, getting ready for the next expedition.
Yeah.
So I was, you know.
So you had developed a certain level of technical expertise as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I had some level of that before, because I used to fix all my own cars and motorcycles, and I was forever taking stuff apart when I was a kid and fixing VCRs and TVs and stuff. So, but actually to do that kind of tinkering with real expedition gear was like a real thrill to me. I really enjoy it. In fact, I think I'll carry on doing it.
Right.
Yeah. Once we get a space at CCI that I can do it in again, because right now we lost our staging space because they had to build new offices there for Gordon Hamilton.
Right, because the institute is always growing.
It's growing so much. Oh my goodness, yeah. But we've got a building in the works. I'm working on that. So I don't know if you know, but right now I'm sustainability coordinator for the campus.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so 80% of my time is spent as the campus sustainability coordinator. So part of my job as sustainability coordinator is, you know, to reduce the environmental footprint of the campus. So that involves, you know, energy efficient technologies, you know, energy retrofits for buildings, but also just doing sustainability initiatives all across the board between everyone on campus, students, faculty, staff, research groups, and... Yeah, so it's great. I'm really enjoying it so far. I've only been doing it a year. But one of the projects I'm working on right now is working with Facilities Management and Climate Change Institute to get this building constructed, which is going to be the new staging space for the Climate Change Institute. So not only is it going to be great to have that new space to work in, but I'm, as sustainability coordinator, and because I can work closely with facilities, I'm getting this building designed in such a way so it's going to be super energy efficient. Wonderful. So it's going to use university technology in its design. Have you heard of bridge in a backpack technology?
I have not.
It's these concrete filled composite arches that are essentially giant fiberglass tubes, 12 to 14 inch diameter. Put them up and then fill them with expanding concrete, and they go rock hard and are super strong. So the structure of this building will be five of those, covered with a stress skin foam panel that will provide great insulation, hopefully over R40. And then on the south-facing side, a 40-kilowatt solar array, PV. So, and then the whole thing will be heated with heat pumps. So hopefully this thing will produce twice as much electricity as it actually uses. That's the idea.
Wow.
So that would be a good... the showcase for the institute as well.
Absolutely.
As well as the university.
Yes. And so that will be constructed, what, near Bryan?
That'll be off the edge of the Bryan parking lot, yeah.
Yeah.
A little patch of grass there near opposite Sawyer and opposite the Sawyer freezer over the other side of the lot.
And this will be a place where you could store equipment.
Absolutely. We'll store equipment, we'll build equipment, we'll clean and fix equipment there. We'll also use it to probably maybe stage some larger scale experiments that need a lot of floor space. And on Science Day, we will use it to educate the public as well. Because CCI does this annual Science Day thing where we have like 200 to 400 kids come through and look at various aspects of what we do. So normally what I do is build the drill tent, and then operate the drill, you know, just in the air so they can see it spinning.
Yeah, that's really neat.
But I can't do that anymore because our space got taken.
Yeah, which is unfortunate.
It is. So that's 80% of my time as sustainability coordinator, and currently only 20% of my time is Climate Change Institute, still working with Paul and Andre and the rest of the crew there.
When's the last time you've gone on an expedition?
My last expedition was, I think it was February 2013. It's about a year ago.
Yeah.
Went back to the central Chilean Andes for the fourth year running. So our first expedition there was 2010. And we went back in 11 and 12 and then finally in 13. And in 13, we had a film crew with us. I don't know if you've heard of an upcoming climate documentary by David Cameron, famous director, did Titanic.
Yes.
And yeah, so he's doing this climate documentary called Years of Living Dangerously. If you go on YouTube, you can see all clips for it and stuff. And he's got all kinds of big names in it. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the guy from the Bourne series.
Matt Damon.
Yeah, he's in it. Okay. Some other famous movie stars. And basically the way he's doing it, he's getting these stars to like go around the world and act as kind of hosts, asking questions and being filmed, like exploring like things that are going on around the world. And it's going to be amazing. It's going to be an 8-part Showtime series or something like that.
Yeah.
It's going to be pretty amazing. Our fourth year in Tupunga Tito, which was the volcano that we've been going up and down for the last few years, we took the crew with us. And they filmed us, and they mainly filmed Paul, but Mario, Bjorn, and I, we were like the supporting scientists, and we got interviewed and filmed as well. So it was great.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll actually make an appearance.
Sure.
In the show, that's what I hope.
Yeah, well, that'd be pretty wonderful.
Yeah, so that was my last trip. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping I get a chance to go again, but since then... it was the year before. I've got to get my time hat on. So the year before, we were in the field, same place, same time of year, and I had to leave early because my wife was supposed to be giving birth 11 days later.
Wow.
And she did. She ended up giving birth 9 days late. And that ended up, the day she gave birth ended up being the day that they all got home. But, yeah, she wouldn't have forgiven me if I'd missed that.
No, I imagine not.
It was our first. So then the following year, he would have been one. But it was a short trip because it was really going there just to take some shallow samples. We weren't drilling a deep core. We could travel light. We had the film crew with us. And so... she let me go the second year, and he was a month old, and so I was gone for a month. Mm-hmm. Plus, I'd gone for a month at the end of 2012 with the South Georgia trip as well. Mm-hmm. So my wife's pretty good. She lets me go on these things. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, if some more come up, she'll let me go as well.
Sure.
But so far, they haven't come up, because since then, a lot of new grad students have arrived at the Institute, and they are now, you know, out and about, up in the mountains and on the ice and doing all the stuff that I used to do.
Sure, sure.
So I'm feeling a bit old these days. Yeah.
So, what had you heard about the Institute before coming? I mean, was it...
Nothing. Yeah. Literally, I got that email from my paleoceanography professor. At that point, I started going online and reading about it. And then it turns out Paul came up from University of New Hampshire because he was at the Climate Change Research Center down there. And he basically, I think he got headhunted by UMaine.
Right, they recruited him.
And they recruited him. So he came here to be the director of the Institute back in 2000. Mm-hmm. And he's been director ever since, mm-hmm. which is kind of slightly unusual. But he's, I think everyone feels like he's good. He's doing a good job. He's good for the Institute. Mm-hmm. You know, we've, Institute's grown a lot and progressed a lot since those early days.
Mm-hmm. What do you think has been the Institute's most important contribution?
To what?
Climate science.
Well, I think it's hard to say what's the most important. I think there are multiple things that combine together form a very important... So it's a sequence of events that when they occur in the right order, they ended up being extremely important. And I think that... And I think it's not necessarily just the Institute either. I think it goes back to the whole idea of ice ages, you know, these ice age cycles that were originally thought of as being these slow things, you know, oh, we're going into an ice age, really slowly it's going to get cold. And oh, the ice age is ending, oh, really slowly it's going to get warm again. So I think people like Hal Bourne's, you know, George Denton, I think these guys were, you know, using their radiocarbon dates on moraines, using, glacial geology, figured out that the end of the glacial wasn't really slow and drawn out. It was fast. You know, it was a few thousand years. One minute there was a mile of ice here. A couple of thousand years later, it was gone. You know, that is a fast change. I mean, that's a big deal. So that was the beginning, and then we had people like Paul Majewski. He worked on deep ice coring projects in Greenland that drilled, you know, like an ice core over 3,000 meters deep, and then analyze it in high resolution. And then what they essentially saw was that during the ice age, there was these abrupt changes in the climate, from very cold to slightly to warmer, to cold to warm, to cold to warm. And the ice age is full of them. I mean, there's Danske-Ørsker events, there's Bond cycles, there are other, you know, like much higher frequency cycles as well, like 1500 year cycles. And there's all this stuff going on. And when you look at these records, it's frightening, because it makes you realize, you know, most of the time, climate isn't lovely and warm and stable as we know it, you know, because the last 10,000 years of our climate have been warm and stable and safe. But when you look back at the previous 90,000 before that, it's been like hellish. I mean, completely different world. You know, wind, dust, you know, unpredictable stuff going on. And these... So, when that ice core was first drilled back in the early 90s and mid 90s, they knew that these changes were faster than we had previously believed, but we didn't know how fast, because the ice core was still analyzed at a fairly low resolution, you know, like maybe 20 centimeter or 60 centimeter, and that we couldn't annually date it at that point. You know, we didn't have an annual layer, so we could say, okay, that change happened in 4 years. We couldn't do that. But we knew ballpark figures, and we knew that the change was fast. And then more recently, again, Paul has developed this, with the help of, you know, other people in the Institute, he's developed this laser system that actually goes down. You can zap it on the outside of the ice, mm-hmm. on a clean, nice, clean, flat part of the ice. It doesn't melt it or anything. It just zaps along it. It ablates the surface, and then a machine called an ICP-MS, which is a giant mass spec, can look at the changes in the chemistry. But the advantage of the laser is, so I guess I should go back a bit. So back when they did the Greenland core, the maximum resolution was maybe, you know, like 2-3 centimeter resolution. You know, you analyze this much of the core at a time. Then shortly after that, we developed a melt system here at UMaine, similar to the ones that the Germans were using, a guy called Wagenbach. And the melt system was able to get a resolution of 1 centimeter. So it brought out even more detail in the core and allows you to annually date the core, or sub-annually date the core further down as the layers get thinner. But still, 1 centimeter wasn't enough because, you know, these cores that go back 90,000 years, they're so compressed. Mm-hmm. Their annual layers are tiny, you know, maybe 1 or 2 centimeters. Mm-hmm. So then Paul developed this new laser system, which essentially has a spot size of, you know, like 10 microns. And you can zap that down a meter of core and get 100,000 sample levels. So you're essentially looking at, you're measuring chemistry every 10 microns or every 20 down the core. Mm-hmm. And this is unheard of. I mean, this is technology that we only dreamed about like 5-10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now it's reality. So Paul has taken sections of that Greenland core, the one that he analyzed originally, he's put it on the laser, zapped it over one of these transitions from warm to cold, and it happens in roughly 2 years.
Wow.
2 to 4.
Yeah.
Very, very fast changes. So to me, that's one of the most important things ever to come out of the Institute, is that we have shown that climate can change abruptly over very, very short time periods. And I think a lot of people, you know, it's easy to say that, but to a lot of people it just doesn't sink in, the significance of that. And you think about, you know, our climate right now, it's super stable, super warm. You know, we're all complacent. This is how society has managed to prosper. It's just because the climate has been so stable. And you look at what happens when you get these like crazy storms, like Sandy or hurricanes, or, you know, a couple of ice storms up the coast of Maine. You know, everything is disrupted.
Right.
And everyone's just like holding on, you know, oh, it'll end soon and we'll recover. You know, it'll end soon and we'll recover. So imagine that those storms just go on continuously. Imagine climate changes over a period of 2 to 4 years, and all of a sudden, that's what we're living in. That's, you know, I think that is reality. That is going to happen at some point.
Yeah.
I don't know when, but it's climate can do that.
Mm-hmm. And that's not much time to prepare or adjust. That's a quick...
That's no time when you've got millions of people living within 5 meters of sea level. Billions.
Right.
I think, isn't it like 1/5 of the Earth's population lives within 5 meters of sea level? I think that's something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's some statistic, some calculation. But yeah, it is frightening. And of course, the other thing that I find very difficult for general public to swallow is that global warming isn't necessarily going to be warming. You know, because there's more heat in the system, the global system, it's circulating more vigorously. It's like boiling a cup of water. You know, after a while, the water starts to do this,
right?
Because it's got a lot of energy, it's moving. So that's essentially what we're doing to the atmosphere, putting a lot of energy into it. It's going to start circulating more vigorously. So we're going to start getting, you know, more unpredictable things happening that we're not used to. They may be predictable, but we're certainly not going to be used to them. And I think trying to explain climate change as opposed to global warming, you know, trying to explain to someone the nuances, you know, it doesn't just mean it's going to get hotter. It could get colder, it could get wetter, it could get drier, it could get windier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any of these things can happen. And that's a big, I think that's another big message that's important to keep, you know, transmitting
right.
to the public.
It's, sure.
Yeah, because a lot of people I talk to, like I gave a talk in the union the other day to the UMaine Skeptical Society, and they wanted to learn about climate change, and because they're skeptical, they ask a lot of questions. They're not necessarily disbelievers of climate change, but they are naturally skeptical, which I think is great. I mean, that is the essence of science, isn't it? You just keep asking questions.
Sure.
So I thought that was good. But one of the things that I discovered in there is that, you know, one of the guys, the guy who asked me to go talk, he has a brother who just flat out doesn't believe in climate change. And even if you can show him loads and loads of evidence, say, you know, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. Everywhere, there's stuff happening. 97% of scientists agree that humans are affecting climate and that we need to do something about it. Even if you show him all of that information, all of that data, he still comes back and says, well, the models aren't good enough. We shouldn't change how the world uses energy based upon a model that we don't believe. That's his attitude, and I just don't understand that attitude. Like, don't you want to create cleaner air? Don't you want fresher water? Don't you want to preserve the millions of species that are predicted to die out if we continue warming the planet? It just drives me mad. So anyway, this guy, he has spirited conversations with his brother on Facebook, and sometimes when he can't retort, he'll send me his brother's quote and ask me for advice, like what to say. So that started up quite recently. I find that quite amusing. Yeah. So those are just a handful of things that I think are really important that have come, you know, some of them haven't necessarily come directly from the Institute, but the sheer speed of these significant changes during glacial times, that is definitely something that came directly from the Institute. And I think all of this work all builds upon the work that led up to it. So it's hard to say that one thing's more important than another. Right. You know, I think the whole series of having Hal and George and then Paul and Gordon and Carl and now the new batch are coming along. You've got Andre and who knows, maybe me, Nikki.
Sure.
All kinds of new folks. And it's an ongoing process.
Well, that's all the questions I have. But I do want to thank you for sharing your thoughts. It was all very fascinating.
Anytime. I love telling stories, as I'm sure you figured out.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you've got lots of them.
Yeah.
So it's really wonderful stuff. So, okay, thank you. I'll stop the recording now.